From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, 4 years after Flint was switched to untreated river water, why people there aren't buying state claims the water is finally safe.
People are really, really scared to trust this water. If you lived through a plane crash and you were scared to get on a plane again, I don't think people would fault you for that.
A new documentary on Enbridge, Line 5.
I didn't realize that Enbridge, when they began this project, really thought they were saving lives.
How a shotgun wound suffered by a fur trader on Mackinac Island changed medicine forever.
How the digestive tract worked was a complete mystery to human beings at that time.
And Dearborn's Big Read, a city unites around a book and sharing family stories and recipes. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 4 years ago this day, the world turned upside down for Flint. It happened when then-Mayor Dane Walling and other officials switched the drinking water over to the Flint River and then toasted each other with glasses of that water. The untreated water caused water pipes to corrode. Lead seeped into the water, going into Flint homes and businesses. Over 100,000 people were exposed to high lead levels. And officials, especially at the state level, dismissed the pleas of people who knew something was wrong with what was coming out of their taps. Michigan Radio Steve Carmody spoke with Flint residents as they boarded buses on this anniversary for a rally at the state capitol.
Glory. Father, in Jesus' name, we give you glory, honor, and praise. We ask that you take us safely down the highway. We pray for traveling grace and mercy. For the buses, for the cars, whatever way they going. And then, Father, we ask that you meet us there in Lansing, Michigan today. That change will come. That ears will be open. That eyes will be open. The people that need to hear us will listen to us and bring change that will speak for us. That will cause change to come back in our community. That will fix those things that have been broken by our government. That will fix those things that have tore our city up. And we are rebuilding, restoring, and building up in the name of the mental name of the one we serve. Amen.
Amen. We wanted some clean water because we've been too long without clean water and bath and cooking. That's what brought me out here today. Governor Snyder needs to hurry up, do his job, and get us some clean water because we've been out clean water for like a long time.
4 years too long on this water. It's outrageous. We ain't got bottled water, but we pay outstanding water bills, though, and can't do nothing with this water, really, though, but flush the toilet. It's ridiculous.
Hear our voice that we need clean water, not dirty water, and I'm very tired of it.
Sad. It saddens me. I don't want to break out in tears, because basically that's all I can say.
It's a disgrace to the community and the city right now that we still going through this after 4 years. You know, I'm a local artist here in the area, and I'm just coming here to lend my voice and show my support and let everybody know I'm here still fighting this fight with them. Her brother has epilepsy, and the lead situation made it worse. You see what I'm saying? And right now he's doing good. He's in, currently in Washington, D.C., doing the same thing we're doing right now.
It's really sad that you can go anywhere in America, you can pull up a gas station, you get unleaded gas, but we can't get unleaded water here, and it's terrible. My wife broke out in a serious rash. She can't wash her clothes in the water. Of course, we don't drink it. She can't bathe in it. So every morning I get up, we heat up about 10 bottles of water every morning so she can just wash up. It's a terrible situation. It really is, and all America should be here with Flint backing us with this crisis, because Flint's not the only city to have this problem. A lot of old cities in America have this problem.
The more they talk about how much money's getting poured into the bottled waters, we just looking at the people and things we still are being faced with every day. We got to pay for this contaminated water that's still poisonous and potentially going to harm us in the near future. So, you know, it's real, like, mind-blowing and kind of depressing when you think about it.
Children's teeth are falling apart. We have rampant ADHD We also have a crisis with bed bugs because these people cannot do their laundry properly still. The pipes are not all fixed, and our pods are closed down. I'm getting calls from people that go and eat dinner with my pastor that they need water. They're running out of water. I am running to the store and purchasing water myself to take to Franklin Avenue. It's sad, and they need to bring back our pods.
We need some free water. People is dying here and getting rashes and everything, and I feel like that's not fair that y'all turning off the free water because y'all didn't fix it yet. But y'all can fix buildings and houses and everything downtown, but y'all can't keep it on. Y'all can't fix the pipes for us.
Really, we're no better off than we were at the start of this.
I think the change is going to come, though. Yeah, think it's going to come.
Those were Flint residents Bishop Bernadelle Jefferson, Otis Powell, Robert Michener, Gerald Davis, Ryan Morris, Andia Coble, and James Shepherd. Let's expand on those thoughts with singer, songwriter, and performance artist Tunde Olaniran. He recently wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post titled, "I'm a Flint resident. I'm done paying for water that is not safe." Tunde, welcome.
Hi. So good to talk with you.
It's good to have you back. You know, Tunde, I'm thinking, in that ceremony 4 years ago today, then Mayor Walling said, and here's his quote, "It's regular, good, pure drinking water, and it's right in our backyard. This is the first step in the right direction for Flint." What would you say to those officials?
I think, honestly, a lot of those officials, if you ask them now, would regret saying what they said on camera. I know Dane probably regrets a lot of those moments himself. I think that really, honestly, at this point, we need to think about how we really interact with citizens and residents when it comes to public health and really take stock of the state of Michigan, you know, in terms of the wide disparity and access to things like clean drinking water and access to health care. You know, I feel like 4 years should be enough time to have like learned this lesson, but I'm honestly worried that, especially at the state level, people haven't learned this lesson, and I think they're honestly like just wishing we would stop talking about it, but we're not going to.
The State House on Tuesday approved its budget, $56.7 billion, and Democrats tried to get $8 million in funding to restore the free bottled water distribution in Flint, and they failed. You have tweeted about that decision to end free water. What do you want to say about that?
For someone not living in Flint, it might be hard to understand how traumatizing it is to have lived through this massive environmental crisis. Honestly, like, if you lived through a plane crash and you were scared to get on a plane again, I don't think people would fault you for that, regardless of the statistics of plane safety. You know, I have filtered water, but I still can't bring myself to brush my teeth with it. It's just honestly a matter of, like, human compassion at this point, and I think it's quite cruel to end this bottled water program when there's still so much uncertainty and fear, especially for the most vulnerable people living in Flint who don't have a lot of resources. People are really, really scared to trust this water, and the response from our state and local government, to me, hasn't been coherent enough to expect someone living in Flint to just be able to trust it again.
That's fascinating, Tunde, as you kind of draw that connection to somebody who perhaps has been in some kind, survived a plane accident. You know, as you say, you know, you can show me all the statistics, but I'm going to feel alarmed. And we do have the state saying, hey, tests consistently show lead levels in Flint water are within safety standards.
Yeah, and I think that that's amazing that that's been communicated to, like, on a mass media level. But I'll tell you, like, as a Flint resident, I don't feel like our state and local government has communicated directly with residents in a compassionate way. And waterline replacement processes here are very strange. Contractors come, they don't really communicate well with you. They don't tell you what they're doing. They don't tell you what to expect. They don't tell you how long things will take. So I feel like living in Flint, it's just been this consistent, like, disregard for the dignity of the people that live here.
Why do you think that is, Tunde? Why do you think that is?
You know, this might sound pretty radical, but I think Black and poor populations are just historically and systemically disrespected in this country. And if you look at environmental crises around the country, they consistently are affecting people of color, indigenous populations. I think that honestly, like, even if it's not explicit, there's this implicit assumption that you're disposable, you know, or that you shouldn't care. And as someone who I used to, you know, who worked in public health, and I directly dealt with public health departments at various levels of government in Michigan, that is a problem that I think has yet to really fully be addressed. I've talked with a lot of media outlets and they've asked me, you know, what can the governor do? And I honestly feel like, I don't know if Snyder honestly has the capacity to fully look at some of these issues with a more holistic lens in terms of racial health disparities, for example. I'm just not sure if the capacity exists at this point in terms of like the public health, like medical complex or whatever you would call it, to really say, you know what, there's a systemic issue. And you see in terms of assumptions about access, assumptions about class, assumptions about individual responsibility. It's an issue, honestly. When you look at things like the opioid crisis versus the crack cocaine crisis, you just see in general, there's a lot more sympathy. There's a much swifter call to action. There's a much swifter call to compassionate care and compassionate action for people. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of components to it that have to do with race and class. And as a state, we need to really consider what we privilege in terms of like corporate prerogative versus individual or residential access to safe public resources. Some voices are just given more weight, I think, and some experiences automatically garner like different kinds of sympathy. Even in Michigan, you know, depending on where you go, I challenge a lot of people to think about their assumptions of majority Black spaces and think about how do you really think about those cities? Do you kind of in the back of your mind think, well, you put yourself in this situation, or are you understanding that there's a lot of history that goes into setting up the perfect storm that created something like the Flint water crisis?
Do you believe there'll be a day when Flint is whole again?
I have no idea. Honestly, despite what's going on, Flint is full of really amazing, resilient people. And we're living through something that should never happen, honestly, in a country as wealthy as this. But people in Flint also have like happiness in their lives. And I do want to challenge folks to say, you know what, we live through this. It's not just about this tragedy. People are still really amazing and living in Flint and thriving, but they shouldn't have to be doing it despite something like this environmental crisis. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm the person to make predictions about the future of Flint, but I do have faith in this city.
Tunde Olaniren, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Cindy. I'll talk to you soon.
Still to come, we'll dive into Dearborn's rich cultural diversity and immigrant roots. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Democrats have struggled to find candidates to run for office in Grand Traverse County. In recent elections, Democrats let most seats on the County Board of Commissioners go unchallenged. And only one Democrat has won a county commission race in the last decade. But this November, Democrats will have a candidate in every single district. Interlochen Public Radio's David Castleman reports on the shifting political winds in the Traverse City area.
The Democratic candidates come from a wide range of backgrounds. Linda Pepper is a former veterinarian and a retired high school and middle school principal.
I think of myself as a problem solver. That's what I certainly did all the time as a high school and middle school principal.
Pepper moved to Grand in 2014. She's challenging incumbent Republican Ron Klaus in District 5. Pepper says she never would have imagined running for the county commission 2 years ago.
But the world has changed in the last 2 years, and I am ready to meet the challenges that are coming at us.
Pepper says she wants to find local solutions to the opioid epidemic and wants to tackle the county's unfunded pension debt. Another Democratic candidate is Betsy Kofia. She's an experienced campaigner who ran for the state house 3 times. The slate also includes an accountant, an emergency room doctor, and an energy consultant. Chris Cracchiolo is the chair of the Grand Traverse Democratic Party. He's showing off the party's small headquarters. It's a lower-level office in downtown Traverse City.
Yeah, historically, we've got pictures of Carl Levin and Harry Truman who we honor every year at our Truman Dinner in October.
Cracchiolo took over the position in January last year, months after Democrats were walloped nationwide in the 2016 election. A year ago, he told IPR that the party had a renewed focus on local elections and attracting local candidates. And on Tuesday, which was the filing deadline for most candidates to get on the ballot, Cracchiolo said Democrats were making history.
We're not aware that there have been seven Democrats on the ballot in Grand Traverse County before. So this real significance to us is we want to give the voters of Grand Traverse County choices.
Cracchiolo says in the past, people have given up on local races because they feel they're hopeless for Democrats, and that has made it difficult to attract candidates. But Cracchiolo says local Democrats are energized in the wake of the election of Donald Trump. The party spent months inviting hundreds of local Democrats to consider running for office.
What we're trying to do is change the culture that, yes, there's Democrats here, and Democrats do want to run for office, and they can win races, too.
Traverse City Attorney Grant Parsons is a longtime Democrat. He was a leader in the local party in the 2000s. Parsons says Democrats across the country are expected to do well in the midterm this year.
There's an aura about this election. Everybody is sitting on eggshells waiting to see, is this miraculous Trump backlash and the amalgamation of all these social protests and movements going to produce results?
Parsons says it's a good sign that local Democrats have a full slate of county commission candidates. But Republicans have a natural advantage in Grand Traverse County because there are more of them. Parsons says Democrats need to find a way to beat a highly organized and well-financed GOP.
The question is, are they just going to run candidates, or do they have the infrastructure now and a message to really attract voters?
On the Republican side, five incumbent commissioners are running for re-election. Three of those Republicans have primary challengers. John Roth is the chair of the Grand Traverse County Republican Party. He says he's not surprised about the competition this year.
I think we get good candidates, and I'm glad that the Democrats filled the spots on all the others. We like the competition. I think ideas thrown out by both candidates, both sides, let the voters decide.
Roth says voter turnout will be critical for Republicans. President Trump attracted new people to the Republican Party in 2016. Roth says they need to get those voters out again, especially with a motivated Democratic Party. For Stateside, I'm David Castleman.
Thanks to Interlochen Public Radio for that report. The National Endowment for the Arts came up with its Big Read program to draw communities together. Choose a book, get people reading, talking, sharing ideas. A perfect example is the Big Read going on in Dearborn. Henry Fisher is a librarian with the Dearborn Library. He lives in Dearborn as well. Henry, welcome.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on here.
So, Henry, what book did you choose for the community of Dearborn to read?
We chose The Namesake by Jhumpa Lahiri. It deals with an Indian immigrant family that moves to the United States, and kind of like the issues that they have with being first generation there. But it mainly focuses on the children born there, mainly the son, whom they name Gogol. After his father names him after a Russian author, and the son kind of struggles with his name throughout the whole book, in a sense. And it focuses mainly on Gogol's life and his struggles with his name.
And why did you feel that story was a good fit for Dearborn?
Oh, well, we thought The Namesake would be a good book that would appeal to as many people as possible. The Big Read is to get as many people involved as possible, because it's kind of like a one book, one community program.
And the immigrant experience, how do you feel that spoke to people in Dearborn?
I think that really spoke to a lot of people, because in a sense we're all immigrants, and some of us immigrated later than others, but I mean, I think it speaks to everyone in a sense, and it speaks to a lot of people in Dearborn, which is a very diverse area.
And so the people of all ages, you're asking people to read the book, but you also ask people to submit a family story or a recipe?
Yes, we ask people to submit a family story or a recipe, and we tried to make it as broad as possible to just include as many people as possible. It was open to all ages, anyone. You didn't even have to live in Dearborn to submit a story or a recipe or a poem, and it could have been like a story relating to the immigrant experience or maybe a story about your name. A lot of people have stories about their names. And we also ask people to submit family recipes.
When you ask people to submit family stories and recipes, how many did you get? Was there a good response?
Yeah, we got a good response. We got about 110 recipes, and we've got over 100 family stories and poems. I remember one person, Jason Stanley, he submitted a story. His father recently passed, and he submitted a story about how they would go down to Kentucky, where his father was from. They would go down there, and he wrote that story just about how his dad would drive down there, and they didn't think much of it then, but now it all of a sudden became really significant.
Is there a place online where people can read these recipes and read these stories?
Actually, we're going to try to publish them as a book, and we're going to add the books to the collection, and we're going to sell copies. It's going to be kind of like a fundraiser for future big reads in Dearborn.
What do you think the big read has meant to Dearborn, and what would you say to other communities about doing their own big read?
You can really try to come together as a community under reading one book, and you can have that shared experience of that book. You can reach out to several different groups. We try to reach out to non-readers, people that don't use the library, so it gives us a chance to reach out to people, too, that might not use the library very often.
And I know you've got a big wrap-up event coming up this weekend.
Oh, yeah, we've got that on Saturday, April 28th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Henry Ford Centennial Library. And Jeff Karub is going to be here to do a musical, like a multimedia musical performance, exploring his family experiences with immigration. And then we're going to have some of the authors come in who actually submitted the family stories or poems, and they're going to do like an open mic reading from their works.
So it's a great way to pull the community together. The Big Read, Dearborn, and Henry Fisher is with the Dearborn Library. Thank you so much, Henry, for sharing this with us.
Thank you so much.
Jeff Karub is a longtime reporter for the Associated Press. He is a singer-songwriter, a Dearborn resident, and as we just heard, Jeff will perform at the Big Read Dearborn Wrap-Up this coming Sunday. Welcome back, Jeff. Always good to see you.
It's great to be here, Cindy.
You are certainly a storyteller in your work as a journalist, but that's what you also want to do in your music.
Yes, and I often thought that the worlds were separate, but the older I get, the more I do both, the more I realize one informs the other.
And how do you think the songs and the stories you tell fit into that mission of Big Read Dearborn?
Well, I was born in Dearborn more than a few years ago. I live in Dearborn now. I have roots on both sides in Dearborn. And it's an amazing place. It's a sociological experiment. Ford was an exporter of cars, but an importer of people. And I'm a product, a third generation product of Ford's experiment. And I just feel like it's a place that's just ripe for playing music and telling stories.
Tell us how your family did come to be in Dearborn. Give us kind of the sense of how it all happened.
1912, my grandfather on my father's side comes from what's now Lebanon. He doesn't move to Michigan yet. He makes hats in Danbury, Connecticut. Then he gets called by the $5 a day that Ford was offering in 1914 or so and comes to work in Highland Park. It's Dearborn adjacent, right? Mm-hmm. It's not Dearborn proper. But he's also a Muslim minister. He's an imam. And he wants to serve the people, the growing Muslim community in southeastern Michigan. So he ends up, years later, leading a mosque in Dearborn, what's now called the Dix Mosque or the Dearborn Mosque or Masjid Dearborn. And he was the imam there for several decades, starting with the 1930s. Meanwhile, you have Sidney Feltek, my mother's father, born in 1909 in tiny Norwalk, Michigan. He comes down, the Depression, can't find work, works on the Great Lakes freighters, has some family living in the Dearborn, Detroit area. He comes down, works for Ford starting around 1935, buys a house in Dearborn, 1440 May Street, where I would see him and my mom grew up. So these two worlds don't come together until 1962 when my parents get married, the German, Norwegian, Irish mom and the Lebanese father.
It is such a wonderful story of, as you say, of many cultures coming together under one roof. But this, when you think about Dearborn, it certainly had its era and its history when Orville Hubbard was mayor for 36 years and anyone who was not white was aggressively not wanted by the mayor and many in the city. How would you say Dearborn is today in terms of getting past that chapter in its history?
I think Dearborn is working to get past it. It's kind of hard to live down history. We see this in all areas and people rethinking what their forebears might have said or might have done. But I think things like the Big Read Dearborn, a mayor who constantly talks about the value of diversity in the arts, in everything, really. I feel like Dearborn is getting it now. And there was certainly an era when it didn't get it as far as civil rights is concerned. I feel like things are improving. It's not paradise. Nowhere is. But there seems to be a value placed on diversity that perhaps in other times it wasn't.
So what are you going to be doing Saturday to help wrap up the Big Read?
Well, I'm going to play music. I'm going to tell stories and there'll be slides and there'll be snacks. Maybe I'll have, you know, more people come because of the snacks part. You never know. But I'm going to tell some of my family story. The theme on Saturday is what's in a name. And the idea here is they wanted me to talk about what's behind my name and a little bit about the story I just told about my grandfather's coming to Dearborn and making a life, building a foundation for those yet to come, which is a line in my song Made by Motown. So I'll play four or five songs. I'll tell some stories. There'll be some pictures, a funny video that my cousin made. I just like the idea of celebrating kind of this century of my family in Detroit and Dearborn.
Let's listen to some of that song you're going to be singing on Saturday, Made by Motown, telling your family's story.
Grandfather came downstate, the other across the sea. Both took a shot at achieving their dreams by assembling Model T's. 5,000 parts and $5 a day, it was tough yet enough to take home. Still the best thing they built was not by their hands, but the foundation for those yet to come. For better or worse, man, we've seen much of both after a century. I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown, Motown helped to make me.
How do you think getting people all together under this one tent of the Big Read helps Dearborn, helps a city?
I think anytime you have a project that invites, it certainly doesn't command or require, but invites people to read a book, it invites people to come to events that are ancillary or, you know, tangentially or directly related to that book, I think it just makes people feel invested a little bit. And they start thinking about their own family story, as I did when I learned about this Big Read several months ago. So I think we're all coming at it from different perspectives. I like to say that I hope there's something personal as well as universal in my music. And I think the same thing happens when you read a book. You start thinking about it from your own perspective.
Well, the big event, the Big Read Dearborn, will wrap up at 2 o'clock this coming Saturday at the Henry Ford Centennial Library, right there on Michigan Avenue near Greenfield. Very hard to miss. It's a beautiful big structure. So Jeff Karub will be performing and people coming together. Everybody's welcome and there'll be snacks. Jeff Karub, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy. It was great.
I'm blessed to be writing and playing my songs, the product of hard work and care. Sometimes I feel like the unlikely child of Henry Ford, Aretha Franklin. Come on now, for better or worse, and we've seen much of both after a century. I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown, Motown. help to make me for better or worse. And we've seen much of both after a century. I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown, Motown, help to make me. I'm still proud to say that they helped to make Motown, Motown, help to make me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. I certainly hope you'll join me when Stateside goes on the road. We're doing a live show in Grand Rapids. We'll be at Celebration Cinema North on Thursday evening, May 3rd. We have a great lineup of guests, and we would love to have you there in the audience. Register to attend and get all the details by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Coming up, what is the story behind Dr. William Beaumont's name on so many hospitals in Southeast Michigan these days? We'll be right back with an explainer after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
With 8 hospitals and a medical school named in his honor, many southeastern Michiganders are pretty familiar with the name William Beaumont. But just what did the doctor do to acquire such acclaim in the world of medicine? Joining us now to give us some insight is State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, and U of M medical historian and PBS NewsHour contributor, Dr. Howard Markell. Dr. Markell, when and where did William Beaumont's medical career get its start?
Well, it begins in the early 1800s, and then he joined the United States Army as an Army surgeon. He actually saw some action in the War of 1812. He resigned his commission in 1815 to try his hand at practice, and by 1820 he was back in the United States Army as a military surgeon assigned to Fort Michilimackinac.
Mark, what was life like in northern Michigan near the Straits of Mackinac in 1820?
Well, Michigan had only been a territory since 1805. This is a region where the French and British had been fighting for control of back into the 18th century. So there's no bridge, there's no roads. Transportation was via water. It wasn't accurately mapped yet. The General Land Office surveys had begun in 1816, and it would take 100 years to complete them for the state. So if you looked at maps at the time, this was more a general area than anything else, not specifically defined. But the Straits area, particularly the island, had long been a commercial center for the fur trade, and the American John Jacob Astor came on the scene, a hugely successful businessman, and really capitalized on that, extending the market and growing the fur trade even more on the island. It was truly a commercial crossroads.
Mark, it was this fur-trapping way of life which led Dr. William Beaumont to cross paths with one Alexis Saint-Martin in June of 1822. How'd they meet?
So there was a large annual pelt swap meet. Saint-Martin was there on site waiting to make some trades, and what actually happened was an accidental discharge of his weapon at close proximity to him. Beaumont was on the scene. He rushed to his aid and was able to administer first aid. I mean, there's graphic descriptions of what happened, but the end result was he miraculously did not die. Beaumont's quick action saved him, but he was left with a gaping wound.
All right, let's talk about this, Howard. What did Dr. Beaumont find when he first came to the side of this wounded trapper?
Well, a great deal of blood and a lot of screaming people, but there were several fractured ribs that Alexis incurred. His diaphragm was lacerated, and there was this gaping wound where parts of his stomach and his lung were sticking out. And so it was quite a disastrous muzzle gunshot wound.
Mm. So San Martin did not die. He lived with this fistula, this direct opening into his stomach. How was that possible, especially in the days before antibiotics? How was he not done in by infection?
It's a miracle. And, you know, it took several years before that fistula was healed in a way that we would feel safe with it today, I should say. And he lived with either Dr. Beaumont or in a boarding house for quite a few years and couldn't eat. He had a lot of issues going on and a lot of need for daily treatment until the skin grew enough to form a sort of a rim or a circle around that wound, and he did not die of infection. It's incredible. There's no antibiotics. There's no anesthetics. There's nothing but bandages and wound care.
And we're talking stomach contents, and we know that's not very sanitary. It is. It's an amazing story. When did Dr. Beaumont realize there was something more that he could learn from this accident that San Martin had?
Well, he first realized in about 1822 when he administered a medication into his stomach through the fistula that no one in the history of medicine, no doctor had ever given medicine in this manner. People have swallowed medicine. There are suppositories very early in the history of medicine. There are not yet injections at that point because you don't have hypodermic needles. And people rub things on their skin, but nobody actually administered medication through the stomach. Now, another thing is that the stomach and how it digested food, how the digestive tract worked, was a complete mystery to human beings at that time. And it was something that fascinated doctors all the way back to Hippocrates and probably earlier. There was some process called a coction, where the stomach was an oven, a crucible, that somehow cooked the food so that you could digest it and use the nutrition and then develop the waste products that we all know so well. And no one really quite knew because no one had an internal view while the motor was running, so to speak.
This was the ultimate look at the running engine.
It was the ultimate look. And then about a year later, when Saint-Martin could tolerate food, he started to administer food into the stomach itself through the fistula. He always tied it to a silk string because he found that the digestive juices, the gastric juices, as they called it, did not dissolve the string. And then he would take notes on what the stomach did and how these food products, meat, you know, boiled beef, mutton, vegetables, cabbage, you name it. And he would take very careful, detailed notes of how the stomach digested its food.
And ultimately, in 1833, Dr. Beaumont publishes his famous book, Experiments and Observations on the Gastric Juice and the Physiology of Digestion. What was the medical world's reaction?
Well, they loved it. I don't know what the Amazon score was back then, but it did rather well. But it took a while. It took about 10 or 20 years before doctors were clutching that book to their chests and reading about it because, you know, information simply didn't travel as quickly as it does today. And there weren't the forms of journals or medical reporting that we benefit from today. And, in fact, most discoveries were published as books or monographs. And it was published by a small publisher in the United States. And so it took some time to get around, to get translated. But soon enough, various physiologists and scientists such as Claude Bernard of Paris, one of the founders of modern physiology, called it one of the great medical discoveries of humankind. And this so-called backwoods physiologist, as he was called, because talking about backwoods. He had described something that no one else had heretofore described.
Now, you write in the Journal of the American Medical Association, clearly Beaumont and Saint-Martin's was a complex relationship consisting of more than sympathy and science. Talk about this relationship of theirs.
It was complicated.
It's complicated.
Because here you have a patient and a doctor, Okay, so Dr. Beaumont is treating this fistula. And then he realizes that he has a living laboratory in front of him. And, of course, there's not just the love of science, but there's ambition to discover something and put one's name on it. And after a while, San Martin said, I've had it. I don't want to do this anymore. And so he ran away. And Beaumont chased him through even further backwoods of Canada, because that's where San Martin was from, and then convinced him at various points to allow him to do further studies. That's why the book wasn't published till 1833. And in fact, Beaumont had a sequel plan, but it never came to be. Finally, when San Martin died, his family did not want anyone else to take advantage by exhuming his body or studying him postmortem. And so they let the body stay out in the open for several days until it completely decomposed and smelled even worse than his stomach contents did on that fateful day.
And as I believe you wrote, they couldn't even let the coffin into the church.
No, okay. It was horrible.
And how did Dr. Beaumont's life play out?
Well, it played out rather well. I mean, he then later went into private practice, and he wound up his life in St. Louis, Missouri, and he was championed as one of the great medical researchers of the 19th century, and he remains so to this day.
So, Mark, what is the story behind the fact that Dr. William Beaumont's name is on so many hospitals and buildings in Southeast Michigan today?
Well, part of it's just because he was really renowned in Michigan and Southeast Michigan in particular. More practical, I think it was September 2015, the newly reorganized Beaumont Health System renamed all the different campuses that came under that banner for consistency. So hospitals like Botsford and Oakwood came into the fold. Also, the system has dozens of community medical centers, home services, hospice care. Also, the medical school at Oakland University bears Beaumont's name. But it's far-reaching. There's the medical center in Texas for the Army, the William Beaumont Military Medical Center. So I think you could argue that Beaumont's name is one of the most commonly used, especially in Southeast Michigan, that has a low general public awareness of why until now.
And now we know. Dr. William Beaumont, a name from Michigan's past, continuing to live right through to the present. Dr. William Beaumont died on this day 165 years ago. And a big thanks to the State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, and U of M medical historian and PBS NewsHour contributor, Dr. Howard Markell, for today's lesson in Michigan history. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Keystone XL and Dakota Access Pipelines have made national headlines. But could Enbridge's Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac be even a bigger risk? That's the question posed by a documentary that airs tonight on DPTV, Detroit Public Television. It's called Beneath the Surface, the Line 5 Pipeline in the Great Lakes, and it presents all sides in the Line 5 debate.
We're North America's largest energy infrastructure company. We know how to do it right. We know how to do it safely. We have the best people here working for this company.
Every step of the way, Enbridge has continued to say over and over again, trust us, this pipeline is in brand new condition. It's perfectly fine. And every step of the way, we've discovered that they have not been truthful in their statements.
Mary Ellen Geist is the DPTV Great Lakes Bureau Chief and producer of Beneath the Surface. Going into this project, Mary Ellen, what was your goal for the documentary?
Well, I came on board about a year and a half ago as Bureau Chief, and the Line 5 issue rose up as one of the biggest controversies I was covering in the Great Lakes. It was on my radar from the get-go. And what became clear to me, and I think to all of us at Detroit Public Television, and many people covering the Great Lakes, is there's just so much misinformation out there. And I think it's such an interesting psychological thing, Cindy, because you can't see under the water. You cannot see down there what is going on. There's a lot of suspicion. There's a lot of mistrust. And it was difficult, as even Enbridge will say, they were not exactly transparent at the beginning. And, of course, how we found out that this pipeline even existed is because of the 2010 inland oil spill in Kalamazoo, one of the worst inland oil spills in the U.S. history. So that led, of course, Beth Wallace at National Wildlife Federation on a pathway. We follow her as she tries to open the door to show the world Line 5, actually. She's really the one who made us aware of Line 5. But all along the way, it was difficult to get information. We decided to go forward with this documentary with the help of the Wolf Pack, the Urban Family Foundation, and many other people to just say, hey, what exactly is going on there? And I really feel like we answered a lot of questions for people, but unfortunately, we still have more questions than answers right now, even as we finish doing this documentary and lots of new developments involving the Straits.
Certainly. And one of the things that you remind us all in the documentary is how Governor Snyder reached a backroom deal with Enbridge late last year without consulting that Pipeline Safety Board. Remind us again what that deal was.
So it's an interesting thing. I've been covering all the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board meetings. They work very hard. It's a group of 12 people from all different walks of life. Some are government entities, some represented by environmental activists, some represent business. There's an Enbridge representative. They work really hard. They meet all the time, and they get public input. And they were moving toward getting an alternative risk assessment. There's still a lot of documents being made up right now. There's a risk assessment being made up right now, and it was understood that the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board would look over all the terms of this and make a decision and make a recommendation to the governor. And the governor, behind closed doors, met with Enbridge, came up with 7 safety regulations that Enbridge would have to follow, and basically Governor Snyder said, I want you to just move forward with looking at how to build an underwater tunnel, putting that pipeline underneath that 4.5-mile section between the lower and upper peninsula and build that, and sort of without consulting with them, said, let's move forward with this.
And what did board members say to you about that?
In the documentary, you will see some angry board members who said this not only disses them, it disses the public. And there is a lot of anger right now among the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board, and they feel they're not being listened to, and all the hard work they've been doing is for naught.
You talk to environmental activists, you talk to scientists, concerned citizens, you talk to Enbridge, you talk to members of the Pipeline Safety Board, and you tried to get Governor Snyder to talk with you for this film, didn't you?
Yes, we did, and he did not want to be part of this documentary.
What surprised you, because it did me, as I was watching beneath the surface the Line 5 pipeline in the Great Lakes and saw the actual video of divers inspecting Line 5. What struck you as you looked at that footage?
That was, we want to thank the National Wildlife Federation for getting us underwater footage. We also got some underwater footage from Enbridge. And I do want to commend Ryan Duffy and Enbridge for opening the doors, talking to us, giving us as much information as they could. But when you see the original scuba diving mission that was paid for by National Wildlife Federation to really go take a look at it, first of all, you see zebra and quokka mussels. But what struck me most, and when we show the documentary, actually the first time we had a screening in Ann Arbor, and there were actually gasps in the audience as you see just unsupported pipeline where the surface of the lake drops down. It goes from 50 feet down to 250 feet. And, of course, you can't bend that pipeline down there. So it's just out there in the open hanging out. But, of course, the regulations put in place in 1953 were that these should not be unsupported for more than 75 feet. But what the scuba diving mission showed and documented was that there were some areas for more than 100 to 125 feet that were unsupported. And I think when you see that, it really is shocking. However, I also want everyone to know that we did, you know, talk to many people about many sides of this, and Enbridge continues to say, this pipeline is as safe as it was when it was built in 1953. It is now 65 years old. In fact, Cindy, 2 days ago was the birthday of Line 5, turned 65. Many people just say, a pipeline that old shouldn't be there. But what Enbridge says is there have really been no incidents along the pipeline that have leaked into the water. They do admit, however, there have been 29 spills that have occurred, but they only happened inland.
It certainly brought us a lot of history, too, when we kind of understand it was a ship explosion many, many years ago in Sarnia that made them realize, you know what, we want a different way besides ship or rail to transport, this fossil fuel.
When we began this documentary, I didn't realize that Enbridge, when they began this project, really thought they were saving lives. They thought they were doing the right thing. And when you look at the fervor surrounding this, when it was built, it was an engineering marvel. And in fact, it was built and engineered by the same company that built the Mackinac Bridge. So when it began, everyone thought it was a wonderful thing. We really wanted to show that side of things, and I think Enbridge, too, still believes it is doing what is right as far as transport of oil and natural gas liquids in the Straits, and they continue to say this is the safest method of transportation for these products.
Beneath the Surface, the Line 5 pipeline in the Great Lakes debuts tonight at 10 on DPTV, followed by a special roundtable discussion on the future of Line 5 hosted by Christy McDonald. Is there a way for viewers who don't have access to DPTV to be able to watch your documentary? Because there's a lot of interest, intense interest all over the state about this.
Yes, if you go to our website at greatlakesnow.org, you can actually watch our documentary.
Mary Ellen Geis, DPTV, Great Lakes Bureau Chief and producer of Beneath the Surface. Mary Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Danny Hensel, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.